The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
To another edition of Thought Crime Radio. I'm Rich, and Janelle is busy helping to bring another microcosm into the macrocosm today. In other words, she's helping a baby come into this world, and that baby is lucky enough to have parents who understand the dangers and toxicity of birthing in a hospital under the present child abusive and totalitarian medical system. Many people have been wondering about the title of this show. Although we intend to cover a broad range of issues of secret history, social control, and media manipulation, so far we've concentrated on how the society raises children. Not surprisingly, it turns out that child-rearing and birthing practices are pivotal in creating and sustaining large-scale patterns of social behavior and organization. So any movement concerned with social transformation and liberation must necessarily concern itself with the lessons taught to children in their pre-verbal years. We've interviewed experts about the lifelong importance of the quality of the birth imprint and how American obstetrical medicine has been ignoring and suppressing science and common sense in bringing children into this world. On our website at thoughtcrimeradio.blogspot.com, we have podcasts of leading experts in neonatal and developmental psychology and ecstatic birth, talking about the intergenerational repetition of child abuse, imprinted baby torture and sensory deprivation, and the brutalization of mothers going on in American obstetrics. We've dealt with the sexualized torture and pleasure sensory lobotomy that results from circumcision, and how even girls haven't been immune from the predations of American medicine in its pursuit of social control through surgery. The impact of sexual sensory, pleasure sensory deprivation in adults feeds directly into our high rates of divorce and child abuse. Thus, the cycle is repeated and intensified from generation to generation. But aside from questioning formerly unimpeachable authority figures, what does all this have to do with thought crimes? It turns out that at a deeper level, what we're really talking about on this show is mass brainwashing. the destruction of the family, and the creation of armies of unquestioning, traumatized sociopaths who are helpless and unable to self-organize in the face of the increasingly corrupt and Orwellian socioeconomic system we find ourselves in. We haven't been talking about conspiracies here, at least not yet. Just presenting the provable neurological and psychological data demonstrating that we really don't even know who we are or what we're capable of as a species. This information alone should be enough to cause any thinking person to commit the thought crime of questioning fundamental assumptions about the society we're living in and how controlled and manipulated we really are. And today we have someone uniquely qualified to explain how this early abuse and neglect feeds into the epidemic of violence and militarism which is engulfing this country, and how we might go about raising a new generation of peaceful, conscious, and empathic human beings, an essential undertaking if our species is to survive its own neuroses. On the phone we have Dr. James Prescott, former head of the Developmental Behavioral Biology Program at the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development of the National Institutes of Health, who did groundbreaking research into the impact of abuse and neglect on the developmental neurobiology of children and how the resultant neurological dysfunction feeds into large-scale social and religious structures associated with violent and oppressive cultures. His revolutionary published research, dating from the mid-60s to 1980, was inexplicably suppressed and disavowed by the NIH. You can check out his research online at www.violence.de and ttfuture.org. That's touchthefuture.org. This is his second appearance on the show. Dr. Prescott, are you there?
Yeah.
All right. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
It's so good to have you back on.
I'm pleased to be on again.
You are certainly a leader in this whole field of the science behind raising peaceful and happy children. So I salute you.
Well, thank you.
So today we want to talk about the philosophical and religious implications of all this abuse and how we might go about changing our society to be more peaceful and supportive of itself, of its children, and of its adults. So earlier this weekend, I CC'd a copy of an email that I was conducting a discussion with Janelle and David Chamberlain and some others about the origins of misogyny and how Elena Tonetti, she was the guest on last week, mentioned that in all the cultures that she traveled through in Asia and apparently elsewhere, she's traveled probably most of the world by now, she's found an almost universal pattern of denigration and essentially hatred of the feminine in many of the cultures that she's gone through, traveled through. And I was speculating on how some of this might be related to the actual birth imprint. The birth imprint, of course, is a function, is strongly affected by how we raise children and how they repeat their early experiences in adulthood as parents. So this is all very intricate thread of cause and effect, all entangled in our social institutions and religious beliefs. It's a very complex subject, and you referred me to an interesting paper on affectational bonding and sensory, the connections between the sensory the stimulus of children and adults, and how this is causally related to various social patterns in oppressive and liberated, relatively liberated societies. Could you get into some of that?
Yeah, I like the theme of your radio talk show about thought crimes. And the reference to one of your participants about the almost universal denigration of the feminine. And this is really, I think, gets at the root of the problem. Why is there so much violence against women and her children? It's virtually a human universal. And the roots go, you know, much deeper than the Judeo-Christian, Islamic, monotheistic religious traditions. I reviewed, you know, some of these points of view in an article on violence against women, philosophical and religious foundations for gender morality. And I started off with some quotations that reflected this type of deep-seated animosity toward the feminine. And I began with a quote from Aristotle, where he said, also, as regards male and female, the former is superior, the latter is inferior, the male is ruler, the female is subject. And even before Aristotle, and I am quoting from Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, which was published in 1953, she quoted from Pythagoras, where he said, there is a good principle which has created order, light, and man, and a bad principle which has created chaos, darkness, and woman. And this philosophical concept of gender morality is really at the root of our problems. It's been reinforced in the Judaic religious tradition. For example, woman is the origin of sin, and it's through her that we all die, Ecclesiasticus 25:24. And through the Catholic Christian tradition, St. Thomas Aquinas and Summa Theologica, as regards the individual nature, woman is defective and misbegotten. So we have this extraordinary history of animosity toward the feminine, and the question is, where does that come from? And again, according to the in the Gospel according to Thomas, this statement has been ascribed to Jesus Christ, where he said, see, I shall lead her so that I will make her male, that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. And that, I think, is an historical backdrop to our current problem. How is it possible to have a living system of peace and harmony with these negative, destructive attitudes toward the feminine? And there's no other species on this planet Earth that is so violent toward the female of its species and her offspring than Homo sapiens. So we have to really address, I think, these broader, deeper issues before we can really change our society. And I was really struck by a commentary by the Dalai Lama in his Ethics for a New Millennium, when he talked about the role of religion in society and the nature of religion with respect to spirituality. And I'd like to provide a few quotes, and then we can get into some data. That's reflected in the tribal cultural data that I've been studying so much over the years. And he starts off with saying, connected with this are religious teachings or dogma, ritual, prayer, and so on. Spirituality, I take to be concerned with those qualities of the human spirit, such as love and compassion, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, contentment, a sense of responsibility, a sense of harmony, which brings happiness to both self and others. While ritual and prayer, along with the questions of nirvana and salvation, are directly connected to religious faith, these inner qualities need not be, however. There is thus no reason why the individual should not develop them even to a high degree without recourse to any religious or metaphysical belief system. This is why I sometimes say that religion is something we can perhaps do without. What we cannot do without are these basic spiritual, that is, human qualities. He continues, those who are dedicated practitioners, meanwhile, follow a multiplicity of religious paths. From this, it becomes clear that given our diversity, no single religion satisfies all humanity. We may also conclude that we humans can live quite well without recourse to religious faith. These may seem unusual statements, coming as they do from a religious figure. I am, however, Tibetan before I am Dalai Lama, and I am human before I am Tibetan. So, while as Dalai Lama, I have a special responsibility to Tibetans, and as a monk, I have a special responsibility toward furthering interreligious harmony as a human being, I have a much larger responsibility toward the whole human family, which indeed we all have. And since the majority does not practice religion, I am concerned to try to find a way to serve all humanity without appealing to religious faith. And it concludes, we have, in my view, created a society in which people find it harder and harder to show one another basic affection in place of the sense of community and belonging, which we find such a reassuring feature of less wealthy and generally rural societies. We find a high degree of loneliness and alienation. And so that brings us full square to the principal role of physical affection in human relationships as being the true spiritual path, that is, and the human path, not the spiritual path in the supernatural sense. And this is from his New Ethics for New Millennium, published in 1999.
Wow.
So the question is, how do we change millennia of thinking that has conspired against the feminine?
Do you attribute this just to historical tradition, or, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of opportunities for feedback loops among the generations here.
Well, the thing, we have to, I think, come to grips with this concept of gender morality, that being feminine somehow means being inferior, immoral, and leading to chaos. And this, again, goes way back to the Pythagoras. And we are still under the control of that kind of thinking. And our struggle to be free from that has been ongoing, but it's unfortunately not succeeding. So how do we change these deep thought patterns that have really defined modern human and ancient human societies, particularly as it relates to what the Dalai Lama has pointed out, the basic requirement of physical affection in human relationships?
Right. That really is a thought crime, isn't it? Talking about the biological and spiritual needs of physical affection.
That is right. And when I looked at the cross-cultural data, and looking at the belief structures in these tribal cultures, this is based upon the data that's in the RB Textures, the cross-cultural summary. There's a coded scale called a belief in the high god. And what I found was that of the 19 exclusive matrilineal cultures, where information was available on premarital sex, that 100% of these cultures permitted premarital coitus, whereas 67% of the 84 exclusively patrilineal cultures punished premarital sex. So we have here a system, and let me define what the anthropologists have called a high god. And this is developed by Dr. Guy Swanson. He says, by a high god is meant a spiritual being who is believed to have created all reality and or to be its ultimate governor, even if his sole act was to create other spirits who in turn created or controlled the natural world. Now, in addition to a high god being present, there's also a coded skill of the high god being active in human affairs. And what I have found is that matrilineal cultures either did not have a high god present in their culture, and if it was present, if it's active, it was not involved in affairs of human morality. The opposite was found with the patrilineal cultures. And so here is some very concrete evidence that our behavior or morality, that is our concept of God, that man was not made into the image and likeness of God, but God was made into the image and likeness of man.
Now, there are some who would argue that these are correlations, you know, in some sense, predictable correlations between belief systems and large-scale behaviors. But you actually went much further into the actual neurobiology among primates of how these belief systems impact child-rearing practices and the resultant adult's propensity towards peaceful or violent behavior.
Yeah, but that follows a different pathway, you know, in terms of how I got involved in all this, and it involved the experimental laboratory studies of rearing infant monkeys in isolation or separation from the mother. And probably the most significant experimental procedure in over 50 years of research in this area was probably done by Dr. William Mason, where he reared infant monkeys separated from the mother, one group on a stationary surrogate mother and another on a moving surrogate. And they were reared in separate cages by themselves in a colony where they have social communication based upon the end-of-the-century systems. And what he found is that the moving surrogate mother, that is a Clorox bottle wrapped with a fur rug with a pie pan bolted underneath so that the infant monkey could sit on it, virtually eliminated all the pathological, social, emotional behaviors that have been commonly observed in infants who are separated from their mothers. And this is what led me to the role of the cerebellum. That is our sixth sense, the vestibular system of movement, the vestibular cerebellar system. What's the key element to explain why these monkeys, infant monkeys that were separated from the mother, became depressed, alienated, hyperactive, hyperreactive, self-mutilating and pathological violence as adults. And this led to some exploratory studies of brain function and structure in these monkeys. And a series of studies conducted by Dr. Robert Heath, who is now deceased, at Tulane University Medical School, he found with implanted electrode studies a pathological deep brain spiking activity in the limbic system and cerebellum in these mother-deprived monkeys, or the adult pathological monkeys.
Would you call hypersensitivity of the neural structures?
Yes, and the principal neurophysiological mechanism to account for this is Cannon's law of denervation supersensitivity. That if you deprive a neural structure of its afferent sensory input, it becomes supersensitive and hyperreactive in function. And in a later publication, that was back in the 30s, he elaborated on this, and the point that I wanted to make is that his preparations involve surgical deaffrontation of the neural structure, and what I'm saying is that what we have here is a functional deaffrontation, so that we have, in fact, a functionally deaffrontated brain, which leads to a neurodissociative brain rather than a neurointegrated brain. And it's these processes that account for the widespread psychopathology so commonly observed in our culture.
Which would be violence, addiction, self-mutilation.
Suicide, homicide. That is correct.
Yeah. The reason I brought it up was just to bring our listeners up to date who might not have heard the first show where we had you on. I just wanted to mention, you know, that these are not just correlations that we're talking about between these religious and social and infant rearing practices. There are causal paths that go directly from early childhood experiences into these large scale social pathologies.
In my view, yes.
Okay.
Although the cross culture data is, by definition, correlational. They were conducted as an outgrowth of the experimental laboratory studies, which identified the somatosensory system as the sensory system that is responsible for the psychopathologies identified with rearing infants separated from their mothers.
And you were able to predict with, what, 100% accuracy based on these infant rearing and early adulthood sexual and social mores, how the culture behaved in terms of warlike activities and respect
for
women?
In the animal studies, the variety of psychopathological behaviors is universal. And then extrapolating to the human studies, like cross-cultural studies with tribal cultures, the question I raised with Professor John Whiting, who was Professor Harvard University, who had studied the mother-infant relationship, I had asked him whether there was any data in the human relations area files, which is the broad database of these cultures, where there's information on affectional bonding, that is how much a baby is carried on the body of the mother to correspond with the artificial swinging mother in the experimental laboratory studies. And he said, yes, that book has just come out, 1967, by R.B. Texter, and that would be the first place to look. And that's what I did. And the Texter cultural sample was a 400 culture sample. And there are about a couple thousand cultures in the ethnographic atlas. And so these cultures were drawn from that larger sample, and they were drawn to be independent from one another, that is, the control for cultural diffusion, that is, selecting cultures that were sort of next door to each other was not permitted. And so we could treat these independent cultures as independent. This became the basis of examining at the human level, the failure of providing vestibular cerebellar stimulation, which is also correlated or involves a physical affectional relationship between mother and infant, and the adult violence of the culture, which was started by Philip E. Slater, in which he had quoted torture, mutilation, killing of enemy, captured warfare. It's the most extreme measure of violent behavior in these tribal cultures. And so when I compared the information available on child rearing practices and the adult culture, whether it was violent or nonviolent, this yielded 49 cultures from 400. So basically I found that 80% of these cultures were either peaceful or nonviolent based upon this single measure of baby carrying. And I had to answer the question, well, what accounted for the remaining 10 cultures or that did not fit the pattern? I found that dependent upon whether the culture permitted the expression of premarital sex or not, if it was permitted or punished, I could predict with 100% accuracy the peaceful or violent nature of these cultures. So, although the cross-culture data is correlational in nature, because it's embedded in a theoretical system that predicts causes of relationships, I conclude, you know, that the presence or absence of high physical affectional bonding in the mother-infant-child relationship and the permitted or punished premarital sexual behavior among the youth of the culture was sufficient to predict 100% of the violence of the adult culture or and the peaceful nature of the culture.
In some sense, this is so commonsensical. I mean, in terms of how this only confirms human intuition and you know, the impulses of a mother to carry her baby around and the impulses of young people to get interested in each other.
Yeah, and if we could restore mother maternal infant child affectional bond and have a supporting structure, a supporting positive view sexual affectional relationships, we could virtually eliminate the violence in our culture.
In a single generation, I mean, the listener needs to understand, we're talking about the creation of a new human race here. We don't even know who we are as a species because we are so warped by how we raise children.
That is true. And but it's going to be highly unlikely for us to change our current culture away from its being embedded in this sort of thought crime, you know, that the feminine is immoral, subordinate to the male. The female becomes property of the male and it carries all that baggage along with it.
So do you attribute this to increasing population densities in more advanced cultures? Or, I mean, where do you think that this need for a hierarchical relationship between men and women arose?
Well, that's the big unanswered question. Population density probably has little to do with it. Remember, these thought patterns really has a long, long history going back to Pythagoras, probably some of the earliest recorded events in human history. And so we have to have another explanation. We can turn to, as an example, the bonobo chimpanzee, who behaves opposite in many ways to the common chimpanzee, which is violent. And as we know, the bonobo chimpanzee is not violent. I mean, it's and you examine the child rearing practices, or I should say the infant rearing practices of the Bruno chimpanzee. The mother carries, first, breastfeeds its offspring to about 4 years of life, and it carries its offspring on its back to about early adolescence.
4 years, you say?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so here we have the two key ingredients in early life of the Bonobo chimpanzee, which translates into a nonviolent culture. And when there's stress in the colony, it's released by sexual union. The female copulates with almost every male in the tribal culture. I mean, in the troop. So we have such a bizarre attitude toward sexuality, and also, you know, toward breastfeeding. We are not a breastfeeding culture.
No, not at all. I mean, if we're lucky, the baby might get breast milk through a bottle, as opposed to baby junk food, you know.
Right. And I found in my breastfeeding studies that this goes to the tribal culture data, that cultures that have a weaning age of 2.5 years or longer, 77% of these cultures are nonviolent. And so the evidence is really quite persuasive when you bring it all together. And that one of the changes that I would recommend for the new culture is that we should be breastfeeding our infants at least through the first year of life. And
the WHO recommends 2 years, right?
Well, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, recommend breastfeeding 2 years of age and beyond. The American Academy of Pediatrics says only 1 year. I don't know where they get that recommendation from.
I don't know where they get a lot of their recommendations from. There doesn't seem to be much science or humanity to it.
Yeah, so it's much of this data is posted on the website at www.violence.de, which you mentioned earlier, and so your readers, if they're interested, can pursue this at their own leisure.
I highly recommend the video Rockabye Baby. It's very accessible and very informative.
Yeah, that's all this and much of the data on the website is available on a DVD, available from Touch the Future, so they can access that, by going to the website.
So, in a sense, what we're talking about is trying to reestablish contact with our primordial selves, I guess, our pre-civilizational, biological, spiritual awareness that we're born with as human beings. So how do you envision a belief system or a social, a social organization that would support this type of spiritual growth?
Well, the first step is to acknowledge and affirm the true equality of the feminine with the masculine.
But there seems to be a big emotional block among even women to taking that first step. Like our guest that was on last week, Elena Tonetti, she recently came back from a tour of Asia. And even in India, virtually every country she passed through, she was talking about how even women despised women in these cultures. And it seems to be a deep-seated emotional rejection, not just...
Well, that's because of their theistic, religious, cultural belief system.
Yeah. So this is not easy. This is not not necessarily an easy thing to overcome.
Well, in our own country, I've been advocating for years the gender equality of representation in our Congress. 50% of our Senate should be women. 50% of the House of Representatives should be women. And if that was the case, we wouldn't have to go through this nonsense that we went through yesterday.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
farce.
And thank goodness for Nancy Pelosi. She's a real role model for women and what women can accomplish if given the chance to. Lotsu in the Tao Te Ching actually recognized the primary role of the feminine in human societies. I'd like to share a couple quotes. It says, "Know the male, but keep to the rule of the female." That was book one. Book two, he said, "The world had beginning, and this beginning could be the mother of the world. When you know the mother, go on to know the child. After you have known the child, go back to holding fast to the mother, and to the end of your days, you will not meet with danger." And that goes back to, well,
ancient times
to a Chinese culture which is very patriarchal. And Ashley Montague in The Natural Superiority of Woman expressed the same sentiment. He said, "Women are the mothers of humanity. Do not let us ever forget that or underemphasize this importance. What mothers are to their children, so will man be to man. But we have a society and culture that does not permit mothers to be nurturing mothers. And that is the crisis."
We almost don't have motherhood anymore. Children go directly into daycare. Mothers go to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be an easy system to change. But I certainly applaud you and your efforts in bringing attention to these issues and getting information out to the public. But, you know, I've been at this for over 40 years and see no significant change.
Well, today we have the Internet, thank God.
That is true.
At least.
We have instant replay of video documentary material, which really can illustrate the emotional, behavioral, sexual pathologies of infant separation from the mother, and that's true across, you know, all mammals.
So, I figure that. You know, undertaking this transformation is going to require simultaneous application of effort in both the child rearing as well as the mass scale social structures that we exist under.
Right. And I would like to promote as much as possible that in addition to the proposal that it's time for the Congress to repeal the Hyde Amendment. They go a step further and pass whatever laws are necessary.
What is the Hyde Amendment?
Sure. Huh?
I'm sorry, what is the Hyde Amendment?
That's no funding, no federal funds for abortion.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And but if we had 50% of the Senate being women and 50% of the House of Representatives being women, that Hyde Amendment would have never passed. And that's really the next, I think, revolutionary step that President Obama has to take. And
sounds like he's going in the opposite direction.
Well, there's Nancy Pelosi. And
so
he can carry the ball.
So this exaggerated masculinity in men and the submission and passivity of women in the society, this is sort of a large-scale expression of this idea of the neurodissociative brain?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And you have a long list of characteristics of societies that exhibit these pathologies. You go into, you know, in this one paper you sent me over the weekend. My God, there's just category after category of very specific and detailed behaviors, social mores.
Yeah, it's. I think you're referring to the list that's on the social behavioral characteristics of affectionate, nurturant, and non-affectionate, non-nurturant primitive cultures.
Yes.
And this is I compiled a list of all the statistically significant correlations of the various behaviors described that characterize the affectionate, nurturant cultures and those that were non-affectionate or non-nurturant. And there are under five different categories: societal characteristics, infant-child characteristics, sexual behavioral characteristics, war, violence and crime, and then the justice, religious, supernatural characteristics. And that's posted on the website. And I believe it's also on the DVD.
I can include a link to it on Thought Crime Radio.
Right, and I can send you the specific URL on this so that you can list that later.
Okay, good, good.
And
so you have like Table 6.1 presents some of the social and behavioral characteristics of cultures that inflict pain on the infant by the nurturant agent, the mother, I guess. Such cultures are characterized by the following: practice of slavery, polygyny, inferior status for women, desire for large numbers of children,
right,
which is a reflection, I guess, of the using children in an exploitative way as a way of getting through old age,
right.
Low physical affection for infants, low indulgence for infants. Developing nurturant behaviors in children is low. You know, the children these days are being, especially male children, but even females now are being trained to be, you know, helicopter pilots and combat, you know, military types. Supernaturals are aggressive, as in like vindictive and jealous gods.
Exactly right.
This is,
and then also in the opposite, where there's a high degree of infant physical affection, you have the opposite relationships, that the god is either absent or it's benevolent.
Right.
So if you want an explanation of why gods are violent or benevolent, the roots are in the degree of affectional bonding between mother, infant, and child, which of course is carried throughout the forms of periods of brain development and the life of the child as a young adult.
This is just incredible. I mean, this research is just so amazing. And, you know, it's remarkable to me that you didn't get a Nobel Prize for this. I'm serious. You know, Nobel Peace Prize.
Well,
I mean, instead they sat on it and suppressed it. I mean, what do you attribute this this censorship to?
Well, in the fall of 1974, we got a new director of the NISHD by the name of Norman Kretschmer. And he had really an ingrained hostility to the behavioral and social sciences, and particularly for child abuse neglect. And in fact, I was terminated from 17-year federal career because I defended the mission of the NISHD to support research on child abuse, neglect, and developmental origins of violence. And I didn't think I had a chance of losing that battle, but I did.
That's incredible. I mean, we are spending billions of dollars incarcerating violent offenders, sex predators, addicts. And, you know, the answer has been right under our noses for this long. It's just unbelievable.
Well, that's my view.
But I guess there's lots of money to be made in the corrections industry.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's. But the question is, how do we sound the alarm bells?
Right. That's what we're trying to do on this show. So right. We only have about 7 minutes left, unfortunately. Could you, I guess, just say what you think is the most important for the listener to take away from this?
Oh, boy. That's, well, I think basically we have to reorient ourselves and our thinking about the relationships between the masculine and the feminine, between men and women. And nothing's going to change unless we change that.
We need to.
We have to provide, society has to provide support for mothers to be nurturing mothers. And that means that the mother carries the infant on her body throughout the first year of life. She breastfeeds her infant for 2.5 years or longer. You can't do that by being out in the workforce. So we have a drastic restructuring of how women with infants and young children are treated in society. In fact, I was reading an article today in the Washington Post that a woman, to keep her job and so forth, she was given only a week and a half off after giving birth to a baby. And so she had to put that baby someplace else.
I actually, I read a story several months ago about a, I guess she was in the National Guard, the Alabama National Guard, and she was being sent to Afghanistan. She was in.
Oh, yeah, no, I got involved in that.
Oh, really? And she, she was threatened with court-martial because she couldn't find someone to care for her infant.
Right.
I mean, this is just an unbelievable.
Well, I wrote a personal letter to Secretary Gates on that.
Uh-huh.
And this is.
Did he respond?
Well, I got no response, really. Yeah. Certainly not from his office, but I mean, it got bucked down. The lower officer responded with.
Well, you know, the people are waking up slowly but surely, but it certainly hasn't filtered up to the governing structures yet. It's pretty pretty late in the day to be pursuing this, but better late than never.
Well, that is true. And, you know, there's John Steinbeck in East of Eden, which he published in 1952, had this comment about children. He said, "The greatest terror a child can have is that he is not loved, and rejection is the hell he fears." I think everyone in the world, to a large or small extent, has felt rejection. And with rejection comes anger, and with anger some kind of crime and revenge for the rejection, and with the crime, guilt, and there is the story of mankind. Then another quote, you know, Ashley Montague, "Natural Superiority of Woman," where he says, "Women are the carriers of the true spirit of humanity, the love of the mother for her child. The preservation of that kind of love is the true function of women." And let me, at this point, endeavor to make it quite clear why I mean the love of a mother for her child, and not the love of an equal or an equal, or any other kind of love. So, that was in 1952.
But this knowledge dates back millennia, right? I mean, but somehow it's just forgotten by each new generation until they rediscover it on their own.
That's right. And I always raise the question with my associates. You already hear Ashley Montague being quoted, is lost in the bins of history. Or from John Bowlby, for the example, was saying the same things. You know, we have a very short memory, and we're continually recreating history.
It seems as though, I guess not surprisingly, the institutions that we entrust to keep these memories routinely drop them. We only have memories of ancient battles and intrigues and political assassinations in our history books, for the most part.
That's true.
That's what we teach children.
I done a couple other quotes that bring these things together. This is Professor Hurdy in Mother Nature, definitive text on the subject matter, published in 1999. She says, "Great ape mothers carry the infants wherever they go. Fathers, by comparison, are rarely in direct contact with babies. And it was a mother who continuously carried the infant in skin-to-skin contact, stomach-to-stomach, chest-to-breast, soothed by her heartbeat, nestled in the heat of her body, rocked by her movements. The infant's entire world was its mother." And then, "No wild monkey or ape mother has ever been observed to deliberately harm her own baby." And so I raise the question, as what has happened on this evolutionary trail in which the human female primate has been so violent, so much violence against her offspring?
And with that, I think, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. The next show's hosts are in studio here, and the tech guys and KOPN Tech Radio. But I really want to thank you for being on the show and for all your work, all your unparalleled research into this very important subject.
And thank you very much for having me.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
Bye.